Party fellowship and now a permanent position in the department as a research lecturer. So I have a group of about 10 people. Five of them are situated up the back. They kindly help bring some of the props along and may help in the discussion if I get questions I can't answer. I'll delegate it to the PhD students. So we are an experimental group. I started off when I came here working on fullerenes and then moved into carbon nanotubes and then moved into graphene. And I'll explain a bit more about those. And our aim for the research we're doing is to synthesize nanomaterials, so small materials which have unique properties, and we can then try and use these in electronic applications. So I would guess many people know about graphene. What's made my life easy is going to conferences now where I don't have to introduce graphene, because a Nobel Prize was awarded in 2010 to two British scientists in Manchester, and it made all the media and it's got lots of hype. So I would gather everyone's heard of graphene. Who hasn't heard of graphene? Who's never heard of the term graphene before? Anyone? Don't be shy. It's, all right. So we've got a few. Have you heard of graphite? Right. So graphene is essentially the building block of graphite. So the whole story can be wound back to graphite, which has been around for a very long time and has been used in all sorts of applications. So I'm going to start there and then we'll work our way towards understanding what graphene is. So graphite, almost everyone here has used a pencil, and in the pencil the tip is graphite. And so the beauty of graphite, when we write with a pencil on paper, little bits slide off like this and we can see some contrast. What you're producing here is graphene, fuel-layer graphene. So everyone here has made graphene, unless you're very young and just use biros and pens or computers. So graphite is a layered material. It has like layers of paper in a stack, just layers and layers and layers, and each layer is quite weakly bonded to the other layer, so it's very easy to slide, which is why when you write, layers just slide off the pencil and onto the page. So graphene is one of these layers. So this is graphite, and then graphene is just one of these individual layers. So it's pure carbon, there's nothing in it but carbon, and each of the carbon atoms is arranged in what we call chicken wire, honeycomb, hexagonal structure. So each of these is an atom of carbon, and it's a planar structure, so it's a two-dimensional crystal. So it has, it's only one atom thick, as we showed back here, so these are single atom planes to form a three-dimensional solid. Each graphene layer is added stack on stack. So if we have one layer, it's essentially one atom thick, and it can be infinite in two dimensions, as big as you can produce it in any way you can. So this is the structural form of graphene, and has probably things which we note about graphene. We call this direction, like that, the zigzag direction, because we zigzag along. We call this direction, like this, the armchair direction. So these are the sort of terminologies you use to describe different directions on the lattice. So here is the zigzag direction, running all the way along this direction. Then here we have along this axis the armchair direction. So this is the sort of terminology we use to describe different directions. So graphite is coming from ancient Greek. I cannot pronounce that, so I'm a scientist, not a classics or language person, unfortunately. But essentially means to draw and write. I got that from Wikipedia, so I hope it's right. There's probably some better sources here. Graphite can be natural. There's mines all around the world which can be extracted. So down here I took a photo of a graphite mine in Madagascar. So graphite's naturally occurring. It can be mined, and there's lots of it. It's the highest grade of coal. Essentially, there's no oxygen in there. So a little bit of stats. Natural graphite production in 2008 was more than 1 million tonnes. So there's a lot of production. But you also have synthetic graphite. So natural graphite is often a poor quality material in terms of these layers aren't well ordered and there might be some rubbish in between, so it's not a very high quality material. But you can also produce it synthetically. So the United States produced 198,000 tonnes of synthetic graphene in 2007 and had a value of $1.18 billion. So there's a lot of money in pencil lead. US consumed 200,000 tonnes of synthetic graphite. So in order to not be pure photograph talk, I wanted to put a little bit of science. Hopefully I can get this message across. So, properties of graphite. So it's used in refractories. So this is where they use it as a crucible to pour liquid metal in to do sort of metal work. It's used in batteries. So as the one of the electrodes in the battery to collect the current. It's used in steelmaking as a carbon source. It's used in brake linings, lubricants, pencils, nuclear reactors, and many more things. So this is the graphite that is either synthetic or natural. So graphite also conducts electricity. And everyone knows of diamond. Diamond is also pure carbon. So diamond is an insulator and transparent. Graphite is black and conductive. And the only difference is in the way the carbon atoms are bonded. So the way these atoms bond together changes everything about their properties. So for graphite and graphene and the carbon nanotube and fullerenes, these are what we call an sp2 carbon bond. So it's a hybrid of the carbon bond. So the carbon sort of atom can bond with other carbon atoms in generally three different ways. You have this sp3, where it can bond to four other atoms, which is diamond has. So you have one carbon here, another one there, another one up there and there. That's the sp3, so that's a hybrid orbital. sp2 has a double bond. So this structure here is cannot be planar, because you've essentially got a pyramid-like structure with one sticking out of the top. So it's a three-dimensional, that's got bonds in all different axes. But the sp2 bond is planar. So there's only three bonds which all lie in the same plane, and that's how you get this two-dimensional sheet. So the double bond, when it connects to other carbons, you can start to form a little benzene ring, and the benzene ring is the building block of graphene. It's this aromatic ring structure. And then you can have this triple bonded structure. So what they mean by an sp2 bond is related to the way the electrons are shared by the carbon atoms. So normally for carbon, we've got six electrons, and the electrons will start to fill in different orbitals around the core of the atom. So the first two electrons form an S orbital, which is this spherical shell given down here, one with spin up and one with spin down. And then you have another, so that's two electrons taken care of, but then you've got another four electrons. But with the next set of shells that are filled around an atom are called the P orbitals, shown here. But we've got four electrons. So what ends up happening is the, as shown down here, we end up with four of the electrons distributed. Three form these hybrid orbitals, which are a little bit of S character, a little bit of P character, so mixing these two together. And then one forms a pure pi orbital up in this vertical plane. So what we end up happening is this structure here, which is these form bonds in this direction, and we're left with an orbital up out of plane, sticking up on the graphene lattice. So this is the sp2 bond, and it is the building block of graphene. So when the carbon atoms bond to form a little benzene ring, these electrons, which are in this cloud here, overlap with each other and form what we call delocalization. So the electrons are shared, and they're you can't identify where they are. They're delocalized across this entire ring. And therefore, it needs very little energy to go from one position to another, and it conducts very easily. So the sp2 carbon allotropes can be a fullerene, nanotube, or graphene. And it all starts with graphene. So we take this chicken wire structure, and we roll it up into a... So it's like taking a bit of paper and rolling it up into a cylinder. And this gives you your carbon nanotube, shown here. We can also form a fullerene structure. So you notice this is a ball. And in here, we've got, again, the carbon atoms. But in order to form it's like a football, the same structure as a football. You have a five-membered ring, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And these five-membered rings are needed to give it curvature. So I was lucky to have the students bring some props, so I'll pass these around. Just have a bit more of a look. So this is the carbon nanotube, and this is the buckyball. So this looks just like a normal football, where you have six-membered ring, and then you've got the five-membered ring, allowing it to have curvature. Pass that here, just have a bit of a look. This is the carbon nanotube formed by simply rolling one graphene sheet around like that, but it's got end caps. And these end caps, you can see, contain a five-membered ring. So these five-membered rings allow you to have curvature in the graphene sheets and give you, essentially, the end of a fullerene plus the tubular structure. Just to give you a little bit of a look at these forms. I also brought real samples. So, graphite, as we've got here, it's mined this amount of graphite, which looks like sort of powdery stuff, costs less than a pence. It's dirt cheap, costs nothing. If I do some chemistry to this and transform it to graphene under the hype that exists, that will be worth about £100. So, hype surrounding products, and it might cost me £2 to do the chemical transformation to form this type of solubilized graphene. And then what I've also brought in this little container is the fullerene crystal. So these little balls like to pack together and form a crystal structure, which ends up forming long, needle-like single crystals. That's a C60. The last bit of show and tell, which I've got in this little box, is a sheet of graphene which we've made and then transferred onto a silicon substrate. And you'll be able to see a square on this, which looks a little bit different colour than the other substrate, which is the area of graphene. So hopefully by the time it makes its way around, you can see the graphene which we've got on a silicon wafer, graphite powder which is in a container, some fullerene crystals, and then some stuff in a solution which is graphite converted to graphene in a solution. So, while that's passing around, we can talk a little about it. So the fullerene is a quantum dot, it's zero-dimensional. It's very tiny, it's about 1 nanometer in size. You can even put other atoms inside of it. You can put a single nitrogen atom, heavy lanthanum atom. You can even fit 4 scandium atoms inside of here, so it's a very nice little cage. You can actually put these fullerenes inside the carbon nanotube. We call these P-pods. So I used to do a lot of work on this. So the fullerene can fit nice and snugly inside the carbon nanotube interior, provided the nanotube is the right diameter. So obviously, that big fullerene won't fit in that nanotube, but if I made a slightly larger nanotube, the fullerene could fit inside. And then graphene has the planar structure. Graphene is a two-dimensional crystal. It's very transparent. It's highly conductive. Carbon nanotubes are a one-dimensional structure. They're long wires. They can be up to a centimeter in length. So you can grow 1 centimeter in length and have a diameter of about 0.5 nanometer. So they're highly asymmetric structures, and they conduct electricity extremely well. The challenge with carbon nanotubes has been their synthesis, how to make them in exactly the right place and use them for electronics. But they're used quite extensively now in fibre reinforcements. So here's the structural form of the fullerene. So Nobel Prize was awarded to Harry Kroto, Robert Curl and Richard Smalley for the discovery of the fullerenes quite a while ago, so I can't remember the exact date, but they did some of the very first work, and a lot of it stemmed from trying to understand or examine interstellar medium and to see whether C60 occurs in space. And so they're looking at small carbon molecules that might be found in the solar system or out in other solar systems, and that led to the discovery of this very unique structure. So, Nobel Prize, beautiful chemistry. It was discovered about 20 years ago. What does anyone know of fullerenes? We know that. Can anyone name a product that fullerenes can be found in? Not really. They're scientifically beautiful, but practically almost useless. So I found a few applications dug out. So people have used them in plastic solar cells, but that's really just in the research lab. People in Oxford are interested in using them for quantum information because they're a very nice cage that can hold the charge of one electron and use that for holding the electron spin, so electron can be delocalized across here. people have used them as an MRI contrast agent because you can put gadolinium inside of them. So gadolinium is used as a contrast agent in MRI. And as I mentioned, you can stick some heavy metal atoms inside. So people have put 3 gadolinium atoms inside, made them water soluble, and then put them into rats and then done some MRI contrast agents. But again, the cost of this product is extremely expensive and very much lab confined. The only real thing I've ever seen is this free radical scavenger face cream. So this is a C60 beauty cream that you rub on and it will scavenge all those free radicals and make you look very beautiful. The price down here, 30 grams was £27. Now, I definitely wouldn't let my partner put this on her face. I work with this stuff and we have to fill out these safety forms. And we wouldn't be allowed to rub this stuff on our face. So
I wouldn't. Do you think there's actually any in there,
though? Oh, yes. The C60 is very cheap and affordable. You can make C60 in vast amounts. But C60 doesn't have much use except in face cream. But I wouldn't recommend anyone to buy this. So on to carbon nanotubes. We talked about the single-wall carbon nanotube. We can also have a double-wall carbon nanotube. You can have concentric shells. This is a double-wall carbon nanotube. So carbon nanotubes have a lot of interest as transistors because they can be semiconducting. Also as transparent conducting thin films. So transparent conducting thin film is, if you've all got a mobile phone, you can have a touchscreen. So when we're touching our mobile phone, something happens. These all run with a transparent conducting electrode. So there's a metal which is highly transparent but conducts electricity, so you can form a circuit and we can interact and form solar cells or LEDs, all these types of applications and touchscreens. So you can use carbon nanotubes because they conduct electricity and you can make extremely thin films. You can make a conductive thin film which is nearly 90% transparent. But again, the cost is very high. People are use them for field emission devices. So here's a field emission device with a nanotube grown off the end. A field emission device is where electrons come firing out of this tip. So if you apply a very high voltage between this tip and another source, electrons come firing out. And this is useful for electrons hitting a phosphor to make phosphorescence or using for electron gun sources. Here's a little picture of a transistor which we made in our lab. So this little tiny carbon nanotube here is about half a micron long and it's connected between 2 gold electrodes and acts like a transistor. So this is a sort of nanoelectronic device we can make. The most promising use of carbon nanotubes is simply replacing the carbon fibre and making bike parts and parachutes and all these lightweight, ultra-strong polymer composites. So this is a bike which actually has a carbon nanotube composite in it. I'm not exactly which part, but again, it'd be extraordinarily expensive. So you can produce large amounts of carbon nanotubes now, so the field has moved on. Here's a big mat of carbon nanotubes with someone lying next to them. So this is a vast amount. Again, we're told if you're going to be around this sort of quantity of carbon nanotubes, you need respirators. They're meant to be having asbestos-like problems, so they're highly toxic to your lungs. So this guy's lying next to a vast amount of asbestos, which is quite dangerous. So when you've got massive mats like this, you can start peeling the edge away like this, and you can see these are all carbon nanotubes. This is an SEM picture, so this is looking at probably on the micron scale, and you can start pulling yarns out. And so here's a yarn which they've made by pulling these fibres and turning into a little spindle and making it long fibre structure. So this will have better strength than the carbon fibres that are produced now, and it has better conductivity, but it's much more expensive. So now on to graphene. Why is it useful? Well, for graphene, the big thing which got these two guys the Nobel Prize was the electrons move extremely quickly in graphene. They move near the speed of light, faster than in any other material. And because of that, there was lots of very interesting physics that could be done. Now, the physics which they explored was extremely complicated, and it's not the sort of thing we would go into here. Maybe in discussion time we could talk about that. It's a semi-metal. Semi-metal means it's a zero band gap semiconductor. So when we think about diamond, which is an insulator, it has what we call a band gap, which is quite large, that we can't excite electrons from the valence band up into the conduction band because the energy is too much. For a metal, we require a very little amount of energy to get the electrons from the valence band into the conduction band. For a semi-metal, essentially, the band gap is zero. So it's a sort of unique type of behaviour which can be both good and bad for different applications. Most promising at the sort of near-term market is the high transparency. So normally for all the transparent conductors which we use for all sorts of TVs, LEDs, solar cells, detectors, touchscreens, generally use indium tin oxide as the transparent conducting electrode. So this is what is coated onto glass, and then it conducts the electricity. But indium tin oxide is not very good if you're making flexible devices. So you've probably seen people rolling out what they call plastic electronics and flexible electronics. These need conductors which can handle the flexibility, and something like indium tin oxide cannot handle that type of flexible structure. So the graphene is very flexible, so it's very good for... it's just like a bit of paper, it's high flexibility. It's chemically robust, so it won't oxidise like many metals. If we want to use copper or aluminium in many applications, they oxidise, but graphene's a very chemically robust structure. So Andrei Geim and Kostya Novoselov won the Nobel Prize in 2010 for their work on the groundbreaking experiments in graphene. And there was a couple of people who whinged about not being included in the Nobel Prize. Everyone wants to be in it. And there was a bit of debate. The debate about carbon nanomaterials and who gets the Nobel Prize always comes from using the word discovery. So graphene, when was it discovered? Well, it's been known for a long time. It's one layer of graphite. And people have been making it with their pencils. So everyone here has discovered graphene, but they haven't been able to show any properties or benefit from measuring it. Similar thing happened with carbon nanotubes. So there's been no Nobel Prize for carbon nanotubes because there's a bit of uncertainty about who discovered carbon nanotubes. So with fullerenes, it was very clear. Proto, Smalley, and Curl used an arc discharge or laser ablation of carbon and formed the fullerenes and showed that they formed it for the first time. For carbon nanotubes, a Japanese scientist found carbon nanotubes amongst some carbon soot under the electron microscope and published the first paper saying he could find carbon nanotubes. But it's been shown about 20, 30 years ago, Russian scientists had found carbon nanotubes prior to the Japanese scientist, but they published it in an obscure Russian journal, which was in Russian, and no one could access this until more recently. So there's a bit of debate in sort of discovery. So let's look a little bit about uses for graphene. So you can make, replacing carbon fibres or carbon nanotubes, you can make very strong polymer composites. The sp2 bond, if we sort of go back, these sp2 bonds are extremely strong. To break one of these requires a vast amount of energy. So the what we call the Young's modulus, or the sort of strength of the material, carbon nanotubes used to have the highest sort of Young's modulus, the highest, the strongest material measured until graphene came along. So graphene now holds the record for having the highest strength of any material. But it's only one atom thick, so it's very easy to break because you look at the relative forces to the strength of the material. But its high strength and its flexibility and transparency and conductivity make it very useful for electronics, optoelectronics. The high strength makes it very useful for making polymer composites, which are strong, lightweight, flexible. So again, I showed you graphite. You can mine it out of the ground. It's extremely cheap. You can make these polymer composites probably cheaper than you can make carbon fibre composites, because with carbon fibres, you need to first create some types of polymer and then carbonise them, whereas for these types of graphene products, we can dig out millions of tonnes of this natural graphite, do a few chemical processes to separate the layers out, mix them with polymer, and then form these very strong composites. So it's not too difficult. So Samsung have published work on making touchscreens with graphene, so you can even actually get real working functional technology. So what they did is they grew a massive sheet, which was about 40 inches, shown on here, which is transparent. It's 30 inch, actually. And they used this technology to make this touchscreen, purely out of graphene. This is done by Samsung. People have used it for DNA sequencing. So lots of surprising applications for graphene. So this works because you can put in a tiny little hole in graphene, which separates two layers of liquid cell. So the DNA will be placed in a region down the bottom. You look at the current flowing between the two liquid cells separated by a graphene membrane. Now, the graphene is impermeable to all gases and to all liquids, and only the little hole allows something to pass through here. And so by applying the right current, you can start to get the DNA to come through this little hole, and as it comes through, you can measure the current flowing through and get signatures of different base pair sequences. Has anyone heard of the spin-out company in Begbroke? Is it Oxford Nanopores? So this is Hagen Bailey's company where they've used proteins, and they've recently licensed this technology from the discoverers in Harvard. So there's a company out in Begbroke looking to try and exploit this commercially. Here's another little example of energy storage. So when I mentioned before about graphite being used in batteries and also in capacitors, and here's a recent bit of work where they printed on supercapacitors that are very small onto these DVD discs. So using a DVD burner, they took a nice sort of plastic substrate and formed this type of structure here. So a capacitor is something just stores energy, and carbon is very good as the electrode. So what they did was to use this DVD to write in patterns into the graphene structure, form this electrolyte, form a little tiny capacitor, and then could print hundreds of them on these little circuits. Now these were able to charge extremely quickly and provide a lot of energy for powering up all sorts of devices. So again, people have used and are using graphene as the electrode, the current collector, in lithium-ion batteries. So in a way, it's replacing graphite with graphene. And if you want to do high-impact research or convince investors that what you're doing is cutting edge, just replace graphite with graphene and they'll give you lots of money. So a lot of people who claim they're doing graphene essentially have about 10 layers thick, which is graphite, but they call it few-layer graphene. So it's, you know, when you look through literature, there's careful ways people manipulate the naming of materials. So the holy grail of graphene research that people really want to happen is in transistors to replace silicon. So the reason it's very attractive is the electrons can move extremely fast in graphene, much faster than silicon. And if they can move fast, it means you can have high-frequency transistor. It means you can switch the transistor very quickly. The downside is it's a semi-metal, so it doesn't have a band gap. And the problem that this creates is to make a functional transistor, you need to switch it off. But the problem with graphene is the transistors which people make currently can't be switched off, so you're just draining current through the system. So people have designed new types of architectures to solve this. But this is the high-frequency transistor produced by IBM, and they've made them with cycle rates up to 300 gigahertz now, so they can make them extremely fast. And a transistor simply is a bit of metal, source, a drain, another bit of metal, and the graphene is in here, and we have a gate. So current would normally flow from here through the graphene down in here. However, with this little gate here, which is another conductor, and then we've got an oxide, which is insulating. If we apply a bit of electricity here, it should be able to switch off the current flowing through here. That's what a transistor does. You can turn the current on and off with this gate. So by applying a voltage here, we can stop the current flowing here. And then you can switch them back and forth and turn them on and off. And this is essentially the high-frequency transistor. But then Samsung tried to develop a solution to this problem where you couldn't switch off the transistor. So they developed what they call a barrister. And essentially it involves integrating graphene to silicon. So if you try and explain this. So we've got silicon, which is conductive, so it's been doped. And then you've got the graphene here. So there's a metal here connected to the graphene, which would flow into the silicon. And then the silicon's connected to this other electrode. So this is the current flow. And then here's the gate to switch it off, just like I explained before. The difference here is you can notice the graphene is not fully connected to this other contact. By connecting it to the silicon, there's a little barrier that's formed at the interface. And this tiny little barrier, the electrons need a little bit of energy to get over this barrier, and this gives you a transistor operation, which you can switch on and off. And so here's their sort of device, and they can make, not high density, but it's, I guess, a new type of electronic device, which may solve a lot of the issues with graphene electronics. And as I mentioned, it's very flexible, so one of the real promising applications is in these flexible electronics, either for the interconnects, so between each circuit you need a metal which can connect, so you can make a, sort of maybe a thin graphite electrode, and then for the transistor structures, you can make another pure graphene-type transistor, which is highly flexible. So the Nobel Prize was won by taking Scotch tape, graphite, and pressing it onto the silicon substrates I showed you. So real, you know, garden shed type of science. It was a Friday afternoon experiment. So you basically get the powder, which I've got in that bottle, a bit of sticky tape, put that on there, then press it onto the silicon. And amongst that, 99.9% will be graphite. But a little bit, like just this little bit here, will be one layer thick. So the key is by knowing the right substrate to put these flakes onto and really hunting carefully, you can find a tiny little area, and that's your graphene. And then with fancy techniques, we can put contacts and connect to that and do the electrical measurements. And that's how a Nobel Prize was won. And the government has given £50 million to these researchers to make commercial technology. So it's unlikely. I mean, the joke is they're going to buy a big roll of tape and start doing things. There's other ways. So the stuff in the vial which I showed you, so there's two ways for graphene. There's top down and bottom up. Top down is taking graphite and layering it down into one layer. Bottom up is growing it atom by atom synthetically. So this is the powder which I had in that vial which you've seen. We can put it into a certain chemical solution, sonicate it to give it some sound energy, break it all up, and then we can form graphene. And then what people like to do is put it back into a powder, so dry for liquid, and form what they call graphene. But the difference between this and this is only the layer ordering. So in the graphite, the layers are very well ordered on top of each other and form a nice crystal. But in these powdered graphenes, each layer has some rotation, so they're not well coupled. But again, people call this graphene, but it's not one layer, it's a big solid powder. But this is the type of processing people are using for mixing with polymers and making strong composites. I saw a pretty interesting video on YouTube just before I came on an American company that claimed they can soak up oil and dirt with this type of stuff. It was quite good. My group's interested in synthetic graphene. We believe that to make a commercially viable product, you need to have uniformity, reproducibility in large area. So one way you can grow graphene is by chemical vapor deposition. So it's taking a bit of copper, which acts as a catalyst, and converting a carbon source into graphene on the very surface. So original work started with, this is from Samsung, this picture. Original work started using methane as the feedstock. So this is carbon with four hydrogens. But this fancy gas is not needed. People have shown you can make graphene with any carbon source almost. Chocolate, dog poo, cockroach legs, and hydrogen. So you can make this fantastic material with a bit of copper, which is dirt cheap. You need hydrogen gas in there to stop it forming amorphous carbon, and some carbon source, cockroach legs, or whatever you wish. But then you need to get it off the metal, because having a metal on a metal is of little use. So you need to get it off the copper and onto some silicon, which I showed you before on that little wafer. You can see the square. So you can transfer it off. This is all done by Samsung. You can see the little logo there. take the big piece of copper. They then put a polymer support onto the graphene and copper foil, and then they etch away the copper with a etchant solution, and then you're left with a polymer with graphene attached. And you can then transfer that onto a bit of glass or a flexible plastic and do what you wish. So we grow domains by this method. So here you can see pictures of synthetic graphene. These are about 100 microns across. So nice little, these are scanning electron microscope pictures. So we can, this is what we grow in our lab on these copper foils. And a lot of what we're interested in doing is understanding the atomic structure. So with materials, the atomic structure influences the chemical, electrical, magnetic and mechanical properties, all determined by the structure. So how do you see something which is one atom thick and measure its structure down to the atomic level? Well, in Oxford we have out in Begbroke one of the best machines in the world for doing this. It's called a transmission electron microscope. So you have a source of electrons up here which fire down this column, and you have a whole bunch of electromagnetic lenses to focus the electrons down onto the sample and take images with electrons rather than photons. So our system is remotely operated, so we sit in a room separate from this big machine, and we add as many monitors as we can to make it look more complicated than it really is. Put them on the wall, but nowadays this looks pretty lame because this shows old-fashioned. We should have one big massive monitor to be up to date rather than lots of small square monitors. So this gives you an idea of what we transfer our graphene onto a little chip this big. So here's a penny. So we transfer a sheet onto here. If this has a little tiny hole in here. So if you zoomed into this area, it would look like this. So this green area is a silicon support with 2 micron holes. So each little hole is 2 microns. If we zoom in, this is the little holes. So across all of this is graphene, one layer of atoms. If we then zoom into one of these holes, so that's this 2 micron hole, let's zoom into that. Here it is here. Now we choose out of that 2 micron hole, a little section here. We zoom into that, and we arrive to this picture here. We choose a little section of that piece here. We zoom in, we get that. We take this little picture here, we zoom in, we get that. So this is a magnification of 70 million times with a spatial resolution of 80 picometers. Now the reason I showed this is that there's a defect in the lattice. It's not pristine. So you can see running down through here, there's a 4-membered ring, 8-membered ring, 4, 8, and then a 5. So this is a defect structure, which you can see down here that we've created. And this gives you an idea of the type of imaging capabilities that are now available. And this resolution, I think there's no other technique that can get that high spatial resolution. So what my group does is we like to study these defects and try and understand what their structural form is, because you can imagine not many people have seen what the defect looks like. So how do you predict how defects are going to impact on the properties of a material if you don't know what they look like? And so our research is to try and quantify accurately these types of structural forms and tell people this is exactly how the vacancy looks like, and so on. So if you remove one atom, we get what we call the mono vacancy. So this is a missing atom in the structure. This can then rebond, so these two atoms could bond and form this reconstructed form of mono vacancy. If we remove this atom, we then get what we call the divacancy. So these structures are pretty stable, but even in these ones here, it's like having a hole in the lattice, and other atoms like to jump in and dope the material. So we can study these effects. We can also study these things here, which are called dislocations, which relate to plasticity of materials. But in this picture here, again, we've got some nice images showing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then the 7-membered ring, and then the distortion that these defects create into the sheet. So by having this very powerful instrument, we can understand how many defects are in our sample, how much are they destroying the sample, or how much are they influencing the structure, and then start to tell people exactly the form here. So we were able to, the first time, measure this bond here as being longer than its neighbour here. So this is the first time any imaging technique had been able to look at two separate bonds and show a length change. Normally people do this on an ensemble, looking at a single crystal, but here we're looking at two atoms, so this atom, three atoms here, and can look at bond length changes. And then by doing some theory, we can understand that these bonds are changing their length because the electrons have redistributed themselves around this structure because we've caused a defect, and we have less electrons in this region than we do in these regions. So we can start to understand how, when electrons redistribute themselves, you get bond length changes, which is quite difficult. And again, we can form these little tiny holes. I told you about DNA translocation. So here's a tiny little hole. This is 300 picometers. So again, we can form very minuscule holes. So I think that's my time up. I'd like to thank all these people who are part of my group and a collaborating professor and the funders from the Royal Society of Balliol. Thank you.
I'm still slightly reeling from the idea that you can actually see bonds, since I spent most of my chemistry career not thinking that. We're going to take a short break now, just a few minutes.